Good morning, and welcome to this hearing of the D.C. Rental Housing Commission. I am Chief Judge Michael T. Spencer, and I am joined by my colleagues, Judge Lisa M. Gregory and Judge Rupa Ringa. Today is July 17, 2019, and the time is 11:02 a.m. We are convened in the Commission's hearing room, which is located at 441 4th Street Northwest, Suite 1140 B North, Washington, D.C. We are here pursuant to D.C. Law 6-10, the Rental Housing Act of 1985, as amended. This hearing, noticed at 11 a.m., is in regard to the housing accommodation located at 3003 Van Ness Street Northwest, Apartment W. 1131 in Washington, D.C. The tenant petition has been numbered as RHTP16-30842. This cross appeal is between Smith Property Holding Van Ness LP, housing provider, and Gabriel Feynman, tenant. The commission notes that there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the housing provider.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Carrie Busen. I'm from the law firm of Baker Hostetler LLP here in Washington, D.C., and I represent Smith Property Holdings Van Ness LP. Thank you.
Good morning. I am Gabriel Feynman, the tenant. Excuse me, and I am appearing here pro se.
Thank you. I would briefly like to explain the Commission's procedures. Our rules are pretty similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each side will have 20 minutes to present its argument, beginning with the housing provider. Each party must present all of its argument within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal time. In its discretion, the Commission may allow additional time for argument to a party in the event that we engage in questions that occupy a substantial portion of that party's time. Our decision will be issued in writing and sent to the parties. In this proceeding, the Commission does not request nor would it accept post-hearing submissions from either party. Please make sure that everyone turns off any cell phones or other electronic devices. At least put them on silent if you need to access them. The Commission is aware of one preliminary matter in this case. The housing provider filed an opposition brief on July 15, 2019. In the brief, the housing provider moved to strike the tenant's brief as untimely. Mr. Feynman, would you like a few minutes to respond?
Well, I'd like to apologize to the commission for my late filing it. As I explained to the clerk, I was confused by the website that she pointed out was not yet under your control. The website incorrectly explained the procedure when it said that the commission would, quote, notify the parties of the deadline for filing briefs, end of quote. And, you know, the last time I was here before the commission, we had a very strict 30-day period before the hearing in order to submit these briefs. Now it appears this has been extended out to 2 months, which may produce more paper for you. I don't know. But I was confused by that and also by the fact that the law firm on the other side had filed nothing either. So I finally called when it got within the 30-day, or shortly after the 30-day period, I called Ms. Miles, the clerk, who told me that the briefs were overdue, and I brought my brief in the next day. I really apologize.
Okay, thank you. Any other preliminary matters? Okay. Hearing none, we will take the housing provider's motion under advisement. At this time, the housing provider may proceed with his argument.
Good morning. I will be quick on the background of this litigation because this case has been before the Rental Housing Commission before. but just to give you a quick framework, Mr. Feinman resided at 3003 Van Ness from December 22, 2013, and then he moved out on December 8, 2016. So he was there for three leasing periods. He filed his tenant petition in July of 2016 and then moved out a few months later. Since that time, this case has bounced back and forth between the Office of Administrative Hearings and the Rental Housing Commission, and then took a brief stop at the D.C. Court of Appeals. But in October, the Office of Administrative Hearings denied his motion for summary judgment, and he noticed an appeal, and that's how we are here today. Mr. Feinman has been on a vendetta against Smith and Equity, its parent company, for years. We've continued to spend countless hours and resources on this case, and the ALJ below found that this case is not justiciable. There's no standing, it's moot, there's no live personal stake in the controversy to redo almost four-year-old forms for a tenant that moved out of the building 2.5 years ago. Also, since the parties were last here, the Rental Housing Act has changed to clarify how RAD forms are to be completed, and Smith has gone ahead and changed how it fills out the forms. So there's no need for any sort of advisory opinion because the situation will not be repeated. It's my understanding that the regulations will change soon, the forms will change, and this situation should not arise again. There are four points showing why the ALJ below should be affirmed for lack of jurisdiction. First, she properly found that Mr. Feinman lacks standing. She found that she lacked subject matter jurisdiction because of that lack of standing, because Mr. Feinman no longer had an immediate and personal stake in the rent for the apartment at 3003 Van Ness since he moved out in December of 2016. It's buried in the brief, but in a footnote, I believe 55 in his brief on page 18, he essentially concedes that he has a standing problem because he states that he recently filed a second tenant petition for the same apartment for the same period of time, but this time, for the first time, he's seeking to recover overcharged rents during the terms of his occupancy of that unit. This case, the one pending now, has never been about overcharged rents. It's been solely about a 2015 RAD Form 8 and a 2015 RAD Form 9. Smith is of the position that this second tenant petition is too little too late. Smith will be moving to dismiss that second tenant petition on statute of limitations and waiver grounds. And we believe that it doesn't save him from his standing problem. It's also well settled that standing may be raised at any time, and because it goes to subject matter jurisdiction, and it may be raised sua sponte. Jurisdiction has never been a focus in this case throughout the 3 years of litigation because the focus has been on liability. It was not until it went to the Court of Appeals where they noted that his moving out could create a problem. So we moved on those grounds below, and the ALJ accepted it and, you know, found that the case, she lacks subject matter jurisdiction and the case should be dismissed.
So let me ask you quickly.
Yes.
Is it simply his moving out, or is it his moving out and not requesting a fine that's at issue here?
It's both.
So if a tenant moves out of the apartment, let's say, we'll give a hypo, that's not Mr. Feinman. Miss Alicia, all right, so she's in this apartment and she moves out because the housing provider fails to fix chronic code violations. Okay, so she's there, she's fighting for 5 years, and she finally feels like, you know, my kid has lab poisoning, I'm out of here. Does she then lose her case because she left for safer, like for a safer place?
And what is she seeking?
She's seeking, well, you tell me. Like, if it's both, you tell me. Like, does it, is it simply is moving out the only prong that has to be satisfied?
No. In this case, he's only seeking declaratory relief. It's like basically...
So if he was seeking more than declaratory relief, would his moving out then still, would he lose standing?
I don't think so. I mean, it depends on what he sees. If he was seeking rent overcharges, the money back, I'm not sure that we would still have the same argument.
So are you conceding to the point that moving out alone is not sufficient for him to lose standing?
I don't think that that alone is sufficient.
Okay.
I think it depends on the facts of the case. And here, what he has been seeking is to have two forms that are 4 years old be redone, essentially, changing the numbers on the forms. And he moved out almost 3 years ago, and the forms are 4 years old.
And which two forms are you referring to?
There's a September 18th, 2015, RAD Form 8, and a September 22nd, 2015, RAD Form 9.
Let's move to the RAD Form. Let's talk about the 9, because that's the form to the government, right?
Yes.
So does the government have an interest in making sure the form that's on file, like, actually reflects what the tenant was paying at the time?
Well, I mean, the forms, as they were filled out at the time, were filled out as, you know, all of the decisions that had come out thus far from the ALJ or from the OAH supported the way we were filling them out.
Yes, I agree. And then once the commission came into the situation and says, OEH, sorry, you had the wrong interpretation of the law, here's what was supposed to occur. And what was supposed to be on the form is the number that, the figure that the tenant was actually paying, not this quote-unquote market rent, not this rent ceiling, not this whatever figure that the housing provider thinks that they deserve to collect from the tenant, but what they actually collected from the tenant. So does the government have an interest in making sure the forms accurately reflect what the commission says the form should say?
I don't think so for a form that's 4 years old. The forms that we're talking about are from 2015. The entire structure has changed. There's going to be new forms, and Smith has changed the way since early this year in which the forms are filled out. So I don't know that the government has an interest in changing in 4-year-old forms.
Well, what if the government's position was a little different than what you just stated? So you just mentioned that the entire structure has changed.
Yes.
I'll say my view, I'm not sure whether my colleagues agree or not, is that, being transparent here, my name is on the previous decision too. So if we were to say, well, the structure didn't change, the previous decision simply clarified the change from 2006 because that was never clear. So let's say someone was to concede that, okay, yeah, it was ambiguous from 2006 until the decision came out in 2018. But that doesn't change the fact that the law in 2006 was rent charge means what the person actually pays, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're saying that, okay, the government has an interest in 4-year-old forms and the government has a clear interest in preserving affordable housing in the city, wouldn't there be an interest in making sure that the forms from 2015, 2016, forms that are used to calculate future rents and determine what rents are accurately reflect what the person responsible for paying versus this hypothetical number that the government thought they got rid of in 2006?
Well, under what you have just laid out, then you would be saying that every form going back to 2006 is incorrect and needs to be redone? Is that what you're proposing?
No, because the statute only goes back 3 years, right? Statute of limitations is 3 years, so.
Right.
the past 3 years, forms should at least, if a person was to bring it, let's say Mr. Feynman was in his apartment, he stayed there. He was one of your favorite tenants, right? And he's there, and he's like, hey, I want to go back to the past 3 years because this was wrong. And so wouldn't the government have an interest in making sure, going back at least to the statute of limitations, that the form is correct? If not Form 8, Form 8, but definitely Form 9, because that's what you all are disclosing to the government and putting on record.
Right. Well, I mean, it would be our position that the law was more than a clarification and that things going forward need to change, but the law shouldn't look backwards.
I will agree with you if the 2006 abolishment of rent ceilings didn't happen. And so I think the position was that it didn't go backwards. We're basically saying, hey, in 2006, this was the law. Was it unclear? Most certainly. But this was the law in 2006.
I mean, I disagree that we should go backwards. I understand what you're saying.
I respect it. And I appreciate your advocacy. Look, I just wanted to at least be able to engage you in a discussion about that issue. So I appreciate it.
Yes, I hope that it was helpful.
Oh, no, it was very helpful.
Would you like me to proceed?
Yes, please.
Right before we got into our discussion, we were talking about subject matter jurisdiction and how it may be raised at any time in a case, including sua sponte. And we would also disagree with Mr. Feynman seemed to suggest in his brief that if you have standing at the beginning of the case, standing continues in perpetuity. And I don't think that the law supports that. Things can change, and things frequently change, and the law is well settled on that point. The second reason that Smith believes the ALJ should be affirmed is her finding that the case is moot because there's no live controversy. She found that she could not issue an order to the housing provider to correct, refile, and reissue RAD forms. And as we've already discussed, he's not lived in the building for 2.5 years, and the forms are almost 4 years old. And there is case law that says when a tenant stops living at the property, claims for declaratory judgment concerning statutory violations are moot. And that's Brown v. D.C. Housing Authority, which is cited in our brief. Against that argument, Mr. Feynman attacked the cases that were cited by the ALJ, and we disagree and think the cases are supportive. One of the cases was Kropp v. Williams, and in that matter, the D.C. Court of Appeals found that a dispute became moot when the inspector general resigned from his post. So seeking advisory opinion to address an issue so abstract of context with no live consequences couldn't be done. And we believe here that this is essentially an academic interest that he has in the forms, and there's no real live consequence, so her finding of mootness was proper. There were also two other cases, Clark v. United States and Thorne v. Walker. In his attempt to distinguish those cases, Mr. Feynman claimed he was constructively evicted from his apartment. This is a newly raised theory. He's never before argued that he was constructively evicted, and there's no evidence in the record that would support that. The final case that was cited by the ALJ and Mr. Feynman attempted to distinguish was Holbrook Street LLC versus Seegers. Mr. Feynman cited that case for the proposition that substantive issues should be considered over procedural ones. But that case is different because there the procedure issue was a failure to comply with an escrow order. Here, I would submit that mootness isn't a procedural question, like checking the boxes to file a motion. If the case is moot, there is nothing to be considered substantively. The third finding by the ALJ below was that she lacked authority to order the housing provider to correct, reissue, and refile the forms. She found that she lacked the power under DC Code Section 2-1831.09B.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Could the rent administrator bring an enforcement action against the house provider and require them to refile the forms or correct the forms?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I don't want to speculate because I'm not certain.
No, I respect that. The next question for you is, in the notice of appeal, you or the housing provider stated that the interlocutory orders wrongly found that the commission was permitted to interpret alleged statutory ambiguities. Can you elaborate on that? It's point six on page two.
Yes, so our notice of appeal, you may have observed that we did not file a brief in support of it. We filed the notice of appeal as a preventative measure because we obviously agree with the ALJ below, but in the event you all do not, we wanted to make sure that we would not have been prohibited from going appealing up to the Court of Appeals, so we wanted to check all of our boxes.
And in checking those boxes, can you elaborate on number six?
So I just wanted to explain that that background. Yes, so in our, as you and I just discussed, you have found that you thought that the Rental mm-hmm. Housing Act had ambiguities. And we disagree with that. We thought that the statute was clear and we were
I'm going to interrupt. This isn't about whether we agree with the interpretation, but whether the commission is actually permitted to interpret alleged statutory ambiguities.
Right. If you are asking me today to give you some authority to support that, I can't.
So if we look at the history of administrative law in this country, would it find that agencies are prohibited from interpreting statutory ambiguities?
I don't think that is true.
Would you concede that agencies normally have, courts normally give agencies great deference in interpreting statutory ambiguities?
That sounds correct.
Okay. All right. I feel like we're on the same page now, at least for that issue. Thank
okay.
you.
Yeah. Should I continue?
Yes.
Okay. In his brief, Mr. Fineman suggests that the ALJ below waived her ability to make the finding that she did, that she didn't have the power to order Smith to redo the forms. There's no authority supporting that. I don't know of any reason, nor is one articulated in his brief, of why she couldn't make that holding. The focus of this case for the past 3 years until the last 5 months or so, 6 months, has been on liability. There had not been much focus on remedy, and I think that once it got remanded to her and she focused on the relief question, she found that she couldn't do it and she entered it, and I have found no authority that supports the idea that she waived her ability to do so. In his brief, Mr. Fineman also claims that there are many cases where the Office of Administrative Hearings has provided relief where there are no explicit statutory or regulatory provisions for doing so, but he cites none. So I also am not sure what authority would support that argument. The ALJ relied on the Schumann case, which found that the ALJ did not have the power to order an agency to fix a computer system. Mr. Fineman tries to distinguish that case, but I think that case is fairly on point. there, the ALJ couldn't order an agency to fix a computer system. Similarly here, she found she didn't have the power to order Smith to fix the forms.
What if this was a situation where there was a rent rollback, right? So we found, hypothetically, Mr. Feynman still lives in the building, or Miss Alicia's in her building, and we found that, okay, because of these chronic housing code violations, that we should roll back her rent should be rolled back to a certain amount of money. Wouldn't the housing provider have to file the corrected forms then based on the adjusted rent charge?
I think so, yes. But that's different because we're not dealing with the amount of the money here. We're not he's not asking for his rent to be rolled back.
Yes, and the forms would still have to be redone in some way, right?
Perhaps. My final point, because I think I've gone over, but hopefully that's excusable because you and I have engaged in some Q&A. We wanted to point out that at the end of his brief, Mr. Feynman tries to broaden his relief and is now seeking a redo of 2014, 2015, and 2016 forms. I think the record is clear from his tenant petition throughout all opinions and decisions in this case that it's always been about just the September 2015 RAD Form 8 and RAD Form 9, and that he's waived his right to ask for this relief at this stage of the litigation. So I thank you all for your time and respectfully request that the ALJ's decision be affirmed for lack of jurisdiction. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you as well. Mr. Feynman?
Thank you. I'm going to try to be very brief here.
Make sure you speak into the microphone, too, please.
Oh, okay.
You can bring it closer to you if need be, so we could make sure we capture it. Thank you.
Okay, is this better? Okay, I'll try to be brief. I want to start, however, with correcting several mistakes that the other attorney may not be familiar with, or issues she may not be familiar with.
You can. You have 20 minutes. If you feel like that's the best use of your time.
The first is that she says that Smith Properties is now complying with the rulings of this commission. And yet, in the new tenant petition case that I've filed in addition to this case, I went down to the RAD and searched their records. And there has been zero filings of RAD Form 9s, which show the rent increases, and RAD Form 4s that show the previous three-year history of new apartments. There have been zero filings for the last year. None. So the second thing I'd like to just say is that this whole issue of whether there are ambiguities or not in the law that was passed in 2006 is rather strange to me to be raised by Smith Properties. Because in 2006, if you look in the legislative history, you will see that the general counsel for Smith Properties was on the drafting committee for this legislation and attended the meetings that drafted this legislation and was clearly aware of what the intent of the legislation was. Okay. Finally, I want to apologize for not citing many authorities. I'm pro se. I'm not in a law firm. I don't have access to Westlaw. I don't have access to Lexis. My research is done just by Google. And it just does not show decisions of the rental housing of the OAH. So, but in any case, excuse me. This is a case where the OAH seems to misunderstand the breadth of the Rental Housing Act and its purpose of protecting renters. The OAH usually deals with cases where tenants are being charged inflated rents or have had substantially reduced living conditions or services. In these cases, the remedy is to roll back rents or impose monetary penalties on the landlord. For some reason in this case, the OAH seems to think that its only powers involve money. In fact, it seems to think that if a tenant has a complaint that cannot be monetized in dollars to be recovered from the landlord, that the tenant has no standing to even appear before the OAH and continue to appear before the OAH unless the tenant also has a personal interest involved. However, the tenant can have a petition about other things than just money, including those where the tenant no longer has a personal interest. For example, the petition can be for the public good, as explained in the Unger case, which is the leading case on this issue, where the tenant is seen as acting as a private attorney general and even receive attorney's fees. Our own case seems destined to follow the often seen path of ping-ponging between the OAH and this commission. Instead of dealing with the clear and decisive rulings of the Rental Housing Commission on remand, the OAH took another unfounded detour into form over substance. It found justifications for declaring the case moot and declaring the tenant without any standing, all based on factors that were present when the original case was decided in February 2018. Particularly distressing is the claim in this decision that the OAH can only issue orders that it characterizes as penalties or fines. That's in the decision on page 10. Putting aside the fact that ordering a landlord to do something that he is already required to do, as in my case, is not a penalty, this is a startling claim.
Let me interrupt you really quickly, Mr.
Sure.
Chairman. So let's assume that OAH can issue an order to the housing provider to file the correct forms.
Yes.
But the housing provider decides that they aren't going to comply with it.
Yes.
Would you have standing to go to Superior Court to get enforcement?
I believe so, yes.
On which basis?
Of enforcing an OAH order. That's...
Now, on which basis would you have standing? Like, you don't live in the unit anymore. You aren't seeking any fines or anything, right? So you're basically saying, Superior Court, make them refile this form and make them serve it on me as well.
Well, no, I would say to the Superior Court, an order has been issued, enforce the order.
Okay.
And how they did it, whether by fining them or by issuing some sort of injunctive relief, that would be up to the court. I'm not a trial lawyer. I have no idea how these things work.
Okay. You can proceed.
So if this decision were rendered by a new member of the OAH, it might be minimized as an anomaly. However, this was written by the principal administrative law judge for case management and quality control. I really urge the commission to examine this issue and provide clear guidance for the OAH in the future.
Let me be clear. The OAH is an independent agency. We have no oversight over OAH. The only relationship that we have is if you pull a rental housing case from below, it comes here. That's the extent of our organizational relationship.
Even though the OAH says it lacks powers to do things that...
Well, that's a I'm sorry. Part of that is also we aren't DC counsel, and so... You know, it's akin to like an Article III court. They have equitable powers. A lot of times, most times, agencies don't. The agencies have powers that are pretty narrow. And so we can give you a fine. We can put stuff out there. But we can't necessarily make a person do something. So that's when you go across the street for enforcement.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
All
I appreciate
right. Sorry
that.
Sorry to disappoint you, but okay.
I appreciate that. Another thing that I found distressing was that the OAH has established new requirements to continue to hear a tenant petition. They are, one, that the tenant must still occupy the apartment, and also that the tenant has a continuing personal interest in the outcome. Here's one example of how that could be applied. A tenant wants to form a tenant association. In order to do so, she posts a notice on the bulletin board. The landlord tears it down and gives her a 30-day notice. She files a petition claiming violation of the Tenant Right to Organize Act. The landlord then illegally raises her rent. Facing a much higher rent and unable to afford a lawyer to pursue a second claim, or the years of paying the inflated rent into escrow, she decides to move out. The tenant no longer occupies the apartment and no longer has a personal interest in the tenant association. The case would be dismissed because the landlord constructively evicted her. Now, you'd say, why didn't she just file another tenant petition to try to correct this? You had in a case before you last month of Harry Gorell from 3003, and he's been paying inflated rent, you know, hundreds of dollars a month into the landlord-tenant escrow account for years now. You know, thousands and thousands of dollars. And when people are faced with this, what they do is they just move out because they can't fight a landlord like that. Mootness. Then we come to the issue in this case, that if it's now moot. This is my primary reason why I have filed this appeal, and not some vendetta against equity or my idle curiosity. I have no vendetta against equity. You know, I was always a good tenant, and except for the actions I took with the tenant association, they were a decent landlord. So I really have no vendetta against them. I just like to tie up these, clean up these things where people are violating the law. It really annoys me. Equity is claimed as the first thing in its appeal brief, that if this case is moot, then the two previous decisions of this case should also be void and vacated. Upholding the OAH order that the case is moot would open up more distortions of the law. Equity has claimed that the recent Rent Definition Clarification Act of 2018 created a new definition of the term rent charged that it is now following. The claim that this definition is new flies in the face of the legislative history of the Rent Clarification Act, this new act, that says that it was simply codifying the Rental Housing Commission's decisions in this case. Alarmingly, far from following that act, as I just said, they've made no filings of Form 9 and history of Form 4s. This means that if these cases are vacated, if your rulings are vacated, equity can simply go back to claiming that the rents are fictitious high amounts still on file. In fact, looking at their reply brief, what they said was what equity has done after the passing of this act is eliminate the use of rent concessions. That is, the difference between the maximum lawful rent under the Rental Housing Act of 1985 and the market rate of rent for a unit. In other words, what they're saying is that your ruling has no effect. They still think that the maximum amount of rent that they can charge is not based on the actual rent, but instead is based on these inflated rents that they filed with the RAD. Now, this is a particular concern to me as a citizen, because the city is now relocating homeless people to 3003. and paying up to $2,600 for a one-bedroom apartment, far above the real market rate, without knowing the real market price for these apartments. All that the city can see is what was filed in for these apartments in the Form 9s more than a year ago, as opposed to what the actual rent is. So to me, it's imperative that the existing decisions not be vacated and that you grant my appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. First, I want to thank both of you for your zealous advocacy on behalf of your client and on behalf of yourself. We know this is a tough issue, and so we really do appreciate you helping us flesh it out more. It is 11:42 a.m., and this hearing is hereby adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.